Good morning, all. I'm going to call the meeting of the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency's Advisory Planning Commission to order. It is December 9th, 2020. It is right at 9:30, and we're obviously in our virtual webinar, which we're all pretty used to now. The first item on the agenda is to call the roll to determine our quorum. So Tracy, I believe you're going to help with that.
That's right, Mr. Chair. Mr. Oling? Mr. Oling? Mr. Booth? Mr. Calicrate?
Here.
Mr. Comber?
Here.
Mr. Drake?
Here.
Mr. Drew?
Good morning.
Mr. Ferry?
Present.
Mr. Grego?
Present.
Mr. Gavon?
Present.
Mr. Hill?
Good morning.
Ms. Jacobson?
Here.
Mr. Letton? Mr. Plemmel? Mr. Roverud? Sorry, Miss Roverud.
Miss Roverud is here. I just promoted her to panelist.
Thank you, Catherine. Miss Stala?
Here.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Mr. Smokey? Mr. Young?
Good morning.
Mr. Chair, we have a quorum.
Thank you, Tracy, very much. I have some good news to share also. I'd like to acknowledge that Tracy Campbell was recently promoted and will be the clerk of the APC going forward. So congratulations, Tracy. We appreciate your help.
Yes, I agree. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for mentioning that.
Yes, so if any APC members or members of the public have questions or comments regarding APC meetings, please direct them to Tracy. Her email is tcampbell@trpa.org. So looking forward to working with you more, Tracy.
Thank
you.
Okay,
now I need to read. Yes, now I need to read some meeting rules for the day, so bear with me. To observe the meeting, go to trpa.org. Under the announcements header, click on Listen Live, Advisory Planning Commission, December 9, 2020. There you'll find a link to the public webinar hosted on GoToWebinar. To address APC members directly with your comments, please utilize the hand-raising function in the control panel of GoToWebinar, which you'll see under the red microphone. At the appropriate time for public comments, please raise your hand by clicking on the hand icon, and a TRPA staff member will unmute you to indicate that you can begin your public comment. Please state your name. If you've requested a reasonable accommodation from TRPA and have been provided a unique PIN number for dial-in, you will be unmuted at the time you requested to make your public comment. If you're using GoToWebinar's Instant Join web app, please make sure it's opened in the Google Chrome browser. That you allow access to your microphone in order to be unmuted. Okay. To APC members, if you wish to speak, you can alert me via the chat function or speak up when someone else isn't speaking. APC members may only use the chat function to indicate a desire to speak. It should not be used to have sidebar conversations. And due to the limited amount of video feeds available, please keep your cameras off. Unless you're speaking, if you'd like to go ahead and turn it on briefly, I think that's fine. And please remember to mute your microphone also unless you're speaking. Okay, gotten that out of the way. Let's move on to item two, which is approval of the agenda. Staff, are there any changes to the agenda?
Mr. Chairman, this is John Hester. There are no changes. Thank you.
Thank you, John. So we will deem the agenda approved as it was posted for the record. Let's go to item three, public interest comments. If any member of the public wishes to address the Advisory Planning Commission, please use the hand-raising function now and you will be unmuted by a TRPA staff member. All public comments should be as brief and concise as possible so all can participate. I do have the discretion to limit time. Let's see, written comments received prior to the meeting were forwarded to APC members. In the interest of efficient meeting management, the chairperson reserves the right to limit the duration of public comment to a total of 1 hour. Any unheard comments can be submitted via email to tcampbell@trpa.org, and those will be forwarded to APC members. Please note, the Advisory Planning Commission is prohibited by law from taking immediate action on or discussing issues raised by the public that are not listed on the agenda. So let's see, I'm going to turn this over to Catherine to see if there is any public comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are no hands raised to make public comment at this time.
Thank you, Catherine. Let's go to item four, disposition of minutes. We do have a set of minutes in our packet from our October 14, 2020 meeting. Do we have any questions or comments from APC members? Okay. Great job on the minutes, as always, TRPA. Approval requires an affirmative majority of the quorum. So with this one, it looks like we can all just say aye if we are in favor. So please go ahead and state aye if you're in favor.
Aye.
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 Any objections or abstentions? Okay, that motion passes unanimously. Thank you very much. Okay, on to the meat of our agenda. This is item six, which is public hearings. Excuse me, item five, public hearings. Item 5A is on the Tahoe Valley Area Plan Amendments in the City of South Lake Tahoe. They're looking to modify various policies, design standards, and substitute standards, including roof pitch and height, corner building design, parking demand, coverage transfer, and related topics to encourage workforce housing development. The TRPA staff report can be found on page one of your packet after the October 14th minutes. And I'm now going to turn this over to Michael Conger with TRPA to present on this item.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. All right.
Thanks, Michael.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the Advisory Planning Commission. My name is Michael Conger, representing TRPA's long-range planning staff. The proposal before you today is a package of amendments to the Tahoe Valley Area Plan. These amendments are necessary to make an important affordable housing project viable. The amendments primarily deal with building design and development standards and were drafted so that they would not interfere with environmental standards. I'll start by giving a brief summary of why we're before you today with the package of area plan amendments. As I mentioned, the proposal relates to a proposed affordable housing development. Affordable housing has been a major focus both at the state level and regionally. Housing is an important component of TRPA's regional plan, which includes goals and policies that call for development of workforce housing in close proximity to town centers. The regional plan also calls for TRPA to regularly review its policies and regulations to remove any barriers preventing the construction of affordable housing. The state of California has been pushing particularly hard for on-the-ground results by implementing new streamlining and incentive statutes. Through the State Department of Housing and Community Development, the state administers a system where they provide regional planning agencies with an allocation of the number of affordable housing units that they're to plan for, which in turn gets passed down to each county and city. Last year, the governor also issued an executive order calling for state surplus lands to be identified for affordable housing development. We're particularly fortunate in that out of 44,000 possible state-owned parcels screened under the executive order, two parcels within South Lake Tahoe, owned by the California Tahoe Conservancy, received particularly high scores on the suitability criteria. These parcels are considered asset lands, which are buildable parcels that are available to support revitalization of town centers or furtherance of other state or regional goals. Once these sites were selected, the California Department of General Services put out a request for proposals seeking a developer. The developers were selected in June, and we recently received an application for a 248-unit residential community on these parcels to be known as Sugar Pine Village. The project also includes public service uses like child daycare and office space for nonprofit organizations. As with most affordable housing developments, there are time constraints that Sugar Pine Village must face. To be competitive for grants and tax credits, the project needs to receive all of its permits by January. The executive order also requires that the project start construction within 2 years of developer selection. Fortunately, projects like Sugar Pine Village are able to use that new state legislation that streamlines permitting and provides incentives to qualifying affordable housing projects. This helps expedite the city level permitting, but there's no parallel regulation at the TRPA level that allows, for example, waiver of a design standard. There is, however, an opportunity to amend the development standards in the Tahoe Valley Area Plan in a way that doesn't affect environmental conditions, but does help to make affordable housing projects like this viable. And that's why we're here before you today. We've developed a package of amendments that we believe does just that and would enable this project to meet its deadlines for permitting. Because the city has the ability to grant concessions and waivers, you won't see the city taking action on this item first, as is normally the case with an area plan amendment. The city has requested that TRPA take on the lead, the role as lead agency for this amendment. The proposal would amend the Tahoe Valley Area Plan. The changes fall into three categories, building design, parking, and coverage transfer. These changes are focused on the area plan's design and development standards, and so the scope of the effect is limited to Tahoe Valley Area Plan. There are no changes proposed to zoning, land uses, building height, or boundaries, and there are no changes proposed to the Code of Ordinances. These types of broader changes are likely to come out of the housing working group that is currently exploring various policy options to promote workforce housing. As evaluated in the initial environmental checklist, the amendments have been drafted in a way that they would not interfere with attaining and maintaining environmental thresholds. To orient you a bit, the Tahoe Valley Area Plan covers almost 400 acres near the intersection of US 50 and State Route 89 in the western portion of South Lake Tahoe. This area is commonly referred to as the Y. The Sugar Pine Village parcels are located within the Area Plan's mixed use zone and are located near Tata Lane and Lake Tahoe Boulevard just west of the Y. The Tahoe Valley Area Plan was adopted in 2015, subject to the provisions of the 2012 Regional Plan update. It is a component of both the TRPA Regional Plan and the city's General Plan. The Tahoe Valley area includes a regional plan designated town center, and many of the incentives available to town centers, like increased density and height, have already been included in the area plan. The area plan has its own set of design and development standards, which are the focus of the proposed amendments. Height and use standards are set based on 7 different zoning districts. Because it includes a town center and the area has access to existing retail and transit services, the Tahoe Valley area presents an opportunity for infill workforce and affordable housing. Knowing that an application was forthcoming for Sugar Pine Village, TRPA staff worked with city staff and representatives of the selected developers to identify amendments to the Tahoe Valley Area Plan that would make development of affordable housing projects more viable. We identified 4 key opportunities. First, the area plan could allow administrative reduction of parking demand ratios. Secondly, a couple building design standards which appear to be focused on commercial-based development could be waived for residential development. Roof design standards could be relaxed so that the development of a third story would be possible without increasing building heights. And finally, the area plan could allow mixed-use developments to transfer coverage based on the requirements for the component uses. So, for example, a mixed-use project involving residential and public service wouldn't be held to a standard that's actually focused on commercial and tourist accommodation-based development. These opportunities we identified helped to frame the proposed amendments. Now I'll move on to speak a little bit more about the proposal. As I mentioned, it falls into three categories: building design, parking, and coverage transfers. Next slide, please. First on building design, the first two standards I'll discuss have to do with roof design and the ability to achieve a third floor. The area plan currently requires a minimum roof pitch of 5 to 12. The proposal would reduce that to 3 to 12. Minimum roof pitch requirements are intended to promote mountain architecture theme, but we found, for example, that the unintended effect of increasing that it results in an unintended effect of increasing building volume, which then must be heated in winter. So there are potential greenhouse gas implications. The mountain architecture theme can still be achieved with shallower roof pitches because other design standards require such things as natural building materials and building articulation. In recognition of these issues, the governing board recently approved a similar reduction to roof pitch in the Bijou El Tahoe community plan. In addition to the roof pitch requirement, there is also a relatively unique standard in the Tahoe Valley area plan that regulates roof height. At least 40% of a building's height must be comprised of roofing. Under the proposal, this standard would be eliminated. The scenic resources section of the initial environmental checklist addresses these changes. The discussion there finds that the application of other area plan guidelines and standards will still ensure that building design is sufficiently articulated to break up the massing. The next two building design standards deal with development at the corner where two streets intersect. One standard requires that development occur at the setbacks for 50 feet in each direction at any corner. The other standard requires a 45-degree angled entrance with architectural treatment at the corner. This is desired building form for most commercial buildings, but these prescriptive standards do not allow for variations in building design that are more common with residential-based development. Relaxing these standards would allow for more flexible residential designs that allow for internal circulation and better respond to the site. The proposal would alter these standards so they would no longer apply to residential development, or in the case of the 50-foot requirement, it would no longer apply when it would result in encroachments in stream environment zones. They would continue to apply in other cases, such as commercial and tourist accommodation development. Moving on to parking, the substitute parking standard presently refers back to the city's municipal code. The municipal code allows for parking adjustments, but only under a discretionary land use permit with a public hearing before the city's planning commission. Requiring a discretionary public hearing for parking adjustments is inconsistent with state requirements for qualifying affordable housing projects. The proposal would address this by modifying the substitute standard to allow the city director of development services to approve reduced parking ratios when a parking study supports the reduced ratios and ongoing parking management is ensured. In circumstances where the city is prohibited from imposing parking standards, TRPA would take on that role and approve the reduced parking ratios. The next category is transfers of coverage. The issue we're trying to deal with here stems from the fact that many affordable housing developments also include support services like child daycare, which are classified as public service uses. Individually, the uses are eligible for one-to-one transfer of hard, soft, and potential coverage, but taken together, they're considered mixed use and they lose that eligibility. The proposed language would allow mixed use developments to transfer hard, soft, and potential coverage at one-to-one, when all of the component uses are also eligible for such transfer. Mixed-use developments involving commercial or tourist accommodation uses would continue to follow TRPA Code of Ordinances procedures for those uses. An initial environmental checklist was completed for the proposed amendments. The document relies largely on environmental analysis that was done for the area plan adoption and for the regional plan update. And it focuses specifically on the changes being proposed to the Tahoe Valley Area Plan. So the IEC that we completed for this does not review the project itself. The project itself will be reviewed separately under a governing board review. The IEC does conclude that there would be no significant impact resulting from the proposed amendments. In conclusion, the Tahoe region has been presented with a major affordable housing opportunity. To make this project viable, a few amendments are needed to the Tahoe Valley Area Plan. These amendments target development standards that apply only to the Tahoe Valley area, while keeping existing environmental protections in place. Finally, approval of this package of amendments will help the Sugar Pine Village project to meet several time constraints and deadlines. Staff recommends that the Advisory Planning Commission recommend Governing Board adoption of the findings in Attachment D, including a finding of no significant effect. Staff further recommends that the Advisory Planning Commission recommend Governing Board adoption of the ordinance amending the Tahoe Valley Area Plan as set forth in Attachment H. This concludes staff's presentation, and I'm available for any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael, for that presentation. Very thorough. I'm going to go ahead and open this up to APC member comments, questions for Michael. Go ahead and send me a chat if you'd like, or just go ahead and unmute yourself, and please speak up.
Hello, hello. This is Bruce Grego. I'm appearing telephonically today. Could we have a little more discussion about the proposed reduction of ratios for parking? Is that something that's dictated by our recommendation, or is that just another option for the planners at the city?
Reduced parking ratios, right now, the only way to get reduced parking ratios would be to do a public hearing before the Planning Commission. And as you may or may not be aware, Senate Bill 35, which is what the Sugar Pine Village project is applying under, Senate Bill 35 does not allow for discretionary hearings. And so we're attempting to create a pathway to reduce the parking without having a discretionary hearing. And that's that can be done through development service director approval, or in cases where the development services director is prohibited from applying parking standards, then it would be done through TRPA, subject to three things. And the three things are there would need to be a parking study supporting a reduced parking ratio. There would need to be a parking management plan that includes some sort of monitoring. And there would need to be a deed restriction recorded on title that ensures that parking management is ongoing for the life of the project. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
It does, in that it's not mandated. It's a discretion. It provides some discretion to change the ratios. I would like to see if such action is taken that there are parking studies required before such action is taken, because we need to be practical about this. And is the current standard one car per unit? Is that what we're looking at?
The current city standard, I believe, is two cars per unit. Under Senate Bill 35, depending on the location of a project, either zero cars per unit would be required or one car per unit.
But that's not mandated. That's just another tool for the planners, correct?
No, it is a mandate. It overrides the city's ability to impose parking standards.
No, I think what Bruce is trying to get Bruce, clear. Bruce, this is John Marshall. The developer is not required to seek reduced standards. So it is, if they want to propose it, this provides an opportunity for those standards to be considered and approved consistent with California law, while also respecting TRPA's jurisdiction.
Thank you. That clarifies it.
Mr. Chair, this is Tim Calicrate, up on the North Shore. Thank you, Michael, for a very thorough overview of the project. To Mr. Grego's comments, while, you know, reduction in traffic is one of the main tenets going back decades, the practicality is, at least up here in the North Shore, and I, obviously it's a wholly different animal, but I imagine that you folks down at the South Lake are having some of the same issues, that parking is a premium, if not, there isn't enough. And while the one-to-one, is that actually practical, or will there be additional on that site for visitors and whatnot? I mean, I know that there probably is, and in looking at it, it was a little ambiguous, and I just would think that for current and future, there has to be a way to accommodate vehicles, because I think it's unrealistic, at least again, and maybe I'm more North Shore centric and this doesn't apply down at the South Lake. Transportation issues are critically and woefully behind what we need, and people are not going to get out of their cars. It's just a reality. So, you know, I think that being sensitive to that before doing a fiat of saying it's only one per parcel, there might be an opportunity to add some additional open parking spaces to accommodate the needs of that community.
Mr. Chairman?
Thanks, Tim. Yes, Steve.
Just responding
to restrict parking. But in reality, when you restrict the parking, people become very creative and they park in places that they probably shouldn't park. And then the fines come in, and then it's, you know, the monitoring, as you mentioned. So I just bring it up as something that, you know, for the developers to look at as providing some additional parking on site that may not be per unit. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Thanks, Tim. Go ahead, Steve.
This is Bruce Grego again. Based on that discussion, should we eliminate that provision in the recommendation?
No.
I don't think we should go to reduce parking, because I don't think it's realistic based on the fact that public transportation, even on South Shore, has not been adequate to give alternatives to people, and they will start parking every place if they can.
Mr. Chairman?
Thanks, Bruce. Yes, go ahead, Steve. Sorry about that.
That's right. Just in response to the comments from Mr. Calicrate and Mr. Grego, I think a principal difference here is this is a deed-restricted affordable housing project, and it's being located in an area plan, and that's why the density of it and the proximity to services, to retail, to restaurants, it'll be on a transit route. It'll be on adjacent to a multi-purpose trail. The whole purpose of these things is to allow the people who are residents there to not have cars or to not have as many cars. I think the proposal that Mr. Conger has outlined with regard to the parking element of this is fundamental to the project. So I would not be in favor of eliminating it.
Thank you, Steve.
This is Crystal Jacobson with Placer County. I would just echo Steve's comments there. And we're working in our town center communities to do the same thing here, look for opportunities to reduce parking. We've actually done some parking studies to show that we have plenty of parking. We're just not using it as efficiently as we could be. And so given the fact that this is located in a town center, I mean, the idea is that we want to get folks out of their cars and provide opportunities for them to, you know, kind of use the town center walkability assets that you have there at the Y to, you know, obtain services. So I actually kind of like that piece of it, the parking piece.
Thanks, Crystal. Up next is Jason Drew.
Good morning. Michael, could you speak on this particular issue? If I read it correctly, it didn't say that it was eliminating the parking requirement. It was allowing parking to be considered on a regional basis, if I read that correct, right? There is the opportunity to do a regional study to address the parking issue.
Well, there's always that opportunity to do a more of a regional parking solution, but in this particular case, we're looking at a project-by-project basis. So we were a little concerned at the staff level when we were considering the possibility that no parking would be required. That may work in other areas of California, but for example, with snow and things like that, it's hard to park on the streets. So that's not really a suitable alternative. And that's why we put in a standard in there that TRPA would actually approve the reductions in cases where there's a state override on the city. Right now, the parking is specific to the municipal code. And so we're just adding in an alternative procedure to allow for reductions of parking on a case-by-case basis. And that would be subject to those three things I mentioned, the parking study, ongoing parking management with monitoring to make sure that they're actually successful in not creating a parking problem. And the third thing was the deed restriction to ensure ongoing parking management.
Okay. Yeah. The parking study, I misunderstood the way that it was worded, but that's what I was getting at. Cause I think there's been several important points made that need to be considered. One is currently in the current situation, we certainly have less than desirable public transit and multimodal options. But with that said, you know, it's been demonstrated over time as we've worked on these area plans that in many places around the lake, we have more parking than we actually need, even during peak days of the year. The challenge is the parking isn't always located where we need it. And so part of the result of that was that we have been requiring parking on a project by project basis. So to Steve's point, I think we need to be careful about limiting the options on parking on projects like this, because if we continue to move forward with the project by project requirements for parking, we're going to continue along the route that we've been on, which is we end up having more parking than we need. It often isn't located where we need it, and we're unable to think about transit-oriented development, the types of development that we're talking about. This isn't. This is a bit different than a lot of the development that's happened over time. So I would just encourage us as a group to think about what provides the flexibility to the city and to TRPA in this particular situation to address sort of the ongoing issues we have with transit and with parking, so that we have flexibility on this project to decide what's best based on what the data shows us.
Thank you, Jason. Other APC members.
Hello, Brendan, this is Eric Young.
Go ahead, Eric.
Hi, so once again, thank you for the presentation, Michael, that was well done. It did raise a lot of questions for me though, to the points that we just heard. I think we are in an interesting transition here because, you know, if you are working with any of the transportation teams and the transportation efforts that TRPA is working on, you know that developing these alternatives to everybody needing a parking space is one of their top goals. And we work on that consistently, trying to figure out how to create a basin where all these parking spaces aren't needed. But as we sit here today, they're needed. So it's an interesting transition period that I think we're going to have to keep our minds open to how we work through this. So I do appreciate the effort to provide flexibility on parking. But I'm not looking at it so much in regard to this project. And so I apologize for that. I know maybe I should be more project specific, but these things that are being asked for seem very normal to the kind of things any affordable housing developer might have to ask for in any variety of area plans around the basin. And I'm wondering if you see the APC and TRPA in general having to see or looking at other area plans asking for very similar things in order to accomplish their affordable housing goals, because these look really like I said, they look really normal. They look like what we'd hear from almost any affordable housing developer, from what their barriers and challenges are. We haven't implemented our area plan yet. I'm very curious to see if we end up with any of these challenges. You know, we're in Nevada, so we don't have the same parking mandate. But I am very curious, Michael, what you think about the maybe the basin-wide application of some of this flexibility that we're going to be offering here to this one area plan.
Oh, no, I agree with you. I think this is going to come up in other areas as well. And so that's one of the reasons we have this housing working group together that's looking at broader policy issues. It may not be an area plan solution. For example, parking could be something that we do through the code of ordinances and not on an area plan by area plan basis. At the same time, right. I think it's good to consider some of the things that we're facing here. For example, the design standards. You don't really know what's going to happen with the design standards until you put them in place and start working with projects and see what actually is a barrier. And the design standards really are an area plan by area plan consideration. Right. Each area plan has its own separate design standards. So I see that as potentially having to happen on an area plan by area plan basis rather than on a basin wide solution.
Okay, that's reasonable. I see that. Along those lines, I think. One thing that maybe all the area plans do share in common when it comes to design is this phrase or term or ephemeral concept of mountain design, alpine design, that we all try to have created some design around, some standards around to create what we think that means. Is there out there somewhere a 21st century alpine design, 21st century climate adaptive mountain design that isn't based on the old things that all of our area plans revere and are trying to maintain and create that sense and feel? There we've got to be able to, in this day and age, create that same sense and feel in a climate adaptive way. I'm surprised that that's not already out there on the landscape somewhere. And it sounds like that's really kind of all they're asking for is the ability to design a reasonable building. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that. And then I'm done. Thank you, Michael.
I'm sure there are other great design standards, but the whole idea with the design standards is that they're going to be implemented on an area plan by area plan basis to respond to local concerns and local design desires, I guess, local vision. So I'm not certain that we would recommend a particular design standard be applied basin-wide. I think we would continue to allow each jurisdiction to kind of come up with its own appropriate design standards. And I'm sure there are other communities you can look at to see modern mountain architecture. There's loads of communities in Colorado, for example, that probably have great design standard examples that we could pull from if we ever needed to. But that's all I have to say on that.
Thanks, Eric and Michael. I agree, updated mountain design standards in a more, climate-friendly design are needed, I think, in our area plan. Just speaking for me, it's come up several times, so I think that will head that way. What about other, let's see, Ms. Stoller, I see you have a comment. Why don't you go ahead?
Hi, thanks, Mr. Chair, and thanks to Mr. Conger for the presentation, and I really appreciated hearing everybody's comments. The first thing that I wanted to mention is that the state of Nevada, similar to the CTC, maintains ownership of nearly 500 urban lots in the Lake Tahoe Basin. And so what struck me about this is the innovation and the creativity in transforming some of those state-owned assets into parcels that can be used to help promote some of these more larger basin-wide aspirations. And affordable housing is so important to the basin and sorely needed. I just wanted to, I think, recognize the city and the CTC and TRPA for partnering and for pursuing this opportunity. So I just wanted to, I think, start off with that. I think this is an important project and has a lot of benefits. The second thing that I wanted to mention is that from what I understood from the presentation, and please correct me if I'm wrong, the question isn't whether to approve or not approve reduced parking. The question is that, from what I understand, under SB 32, the project wouldn't be able to move forward if there is a discretionary hearing process in place to address parking. And so I wouldn't want to prevent the project from moving forward based on that. I think the question now is, do we believe that it's acceptable alternative proposal for addressing parking? Do we agree with it? Do we agree with this threefold approach? And I don't know that we can, I guess, fully understand that without some more information. The first thing would be, one is the project proponent interested in proposing reduced parking? I think we're all assuming that the answer is yes, but we don't know that for sure. And then the second is, you know, do we find the proposal of having a parking study and ongoing parking management and monitoring, do we think that those solutions will address what we perceive to be the parking concerns? So I would appreciate if there's any information that Mr. Conger could provide. For the parking study, if the project proponent were to propose reduced parking and the planning director for the city were to entertain a parking study and ongoing management and monitoring, would the parking study, would it evaluate any of these kind of concerns regarding spillover effect of people parking potentially in places where it's environmentally not prudent for them to do so? That's my first question. And then the second is, do we have any examples of parking management and monitoring and parcels being deed restricted for that as being a successful model for ensuring parking is being managed appropriately and not having any kind of unintended consequence or environmental effect? So if those two questions could be addressed, that would help me evaluate the question before us. Thank you.
Generally a parking study, the parking study would look at what similar uses are, what the vehicle ownership rate is for similar uses. And so the assumption with that would be that they would also be taking into account any vehicles that were parked on the street that were under ownership of the residential unit. And they arrive at a number, a number of parking spaces per, or a number of vehicles owned per unit. And that would be equivalent to what would be needed to park a similar use, without creating a spillover effect, if that makes sense. And I believe that this particular project did do a parking study and they are proposing a reduced parking rate. They're not proposing a parking rate that is as reduced as the parking study would support, but they are proposing a reduced parking rate. And your second question was about the examples of successful programs that have had parking management. I'm not terribly familiar with a lot of the projects around the basin, so I can't think of anything locally that has had a similar requirement. One of the reasons we're requiring monitoring on it is to make sure that the parking management plan requirements, and I should expand on what a parking management plan might include. Parking management plan would probably include having things like parking passes, having parking separated from the rent, so you have to pay for a parking space separate from the rent. It might include having bike share. It might include having car share. It might include having subsidized transit passes. There's various options that you could do for a parking management plan, but I think the key to it is the monitoring to make sure that what the parking management plan is proposing would actually result in the desired effects. It wouldn't create a parking problem. It wouldn't create spillover parking onto uncovered surfaces, things like that. So I hope that answers your question a little bit. I'm unfortunately don't know the other like examples of a project. I can think of examples in cities where this has been put into place, but I can't think of any examples locally.
No, thank you for that information. That does help, especially the examples that you provided of what alternatives might be included in a management plan. And those also seem to be helpful in the cause of kind of promoting alternative ways to get around without necessarily having to rely on your car. So that was helpful. And I also, I remember too, I know this is a couple years ago and I haven't kept up with it. I don't know the status, but I remember at the Tahoe Valley Greenbelt project, combined stormwater and kind of pedestrian friendly landscaping kind of improvement project. And I was wondering if there was connectivity with this project and maybe that could kind of support this desire to see more people kind of using alternative means to get around rather than relying on their cars so much. So that was my only other thought to that. Thank you.
Yeah, I don't believe the Greenway directly connects to the property, but it is very close to where it starts. So I think if we there may need to be some additional improvements along Lake Tahoe Boulevard in order to have full connectivity to the Greenway, but I it's pretty close.
Thank you.
Thanks, Hillary. Let's see, Hillary, I think, can jump in and maybe help from the city on some of this. Do you want to go ahead, Hillary?
Sure. Thanks, Mr. Chair. First and foremost, I really want to thank the TRPA staff for bringing this forward. Given the California state law that applies to the city's ability to review the project and limiting us to ministerial review and not requiring more than one parking space per unit, it certainly puts us in a unique situation that we haven't been in the past. It's a little bit awkward, but I know it puts more pressure on TRPA to bring these forward, as well as the timeframe that the project is under. So I really appreciate the TRPA staff working collaboratively with all the agencies involved, trying to bring these decisions forward as quickly as possible to the APC and the governing board. So thank you, Michael, and all your coworkers that are working on this. With respect to parking, so I definitely respect and agree with the comments made about folks getting creative with finding places to park their cars and the spillover effect that can potentially happen when there aren't enough on-site parking spaces. You know, from our experience monitoring and doing inspections and multifamily projects, it's really the projects where there isn't good on-site management where we see that happening. Where you see the second car or even the broken down car parked in the forest across the street. Those are really, it's more common in older multifamily properties that do not have on-site property management. With these affordable housing projects, you know, they are under a lot of scrutiny and long-term monitoring when it comes to property maintenance and property management. And that is typically a function of conditions of approval put on a permit, but it is also tied to their funding. When there's public funding involved in these projects, whether it's tax credits or CDBG, home funding, any other, you know, housing funding source, there is long-term monitoring required, and typically that's like a 50-year time frame. So the projects that we have in the city that fall into that category of deed-restricted affordable housing with the long-term monitoring, we don't see those problems associated with spillover parking. The on-site management does a very good job of making sure that their tenants understand what the parking requirements are and stay within those. A good example is right across Lake Tahoe Boulevard from this proposed Sugar Pine Village project site is the Sierra Gardens affordable housing project. They also have a reduced parking requirement. They have very good on-site management, and we don't see those kinds of problems and creativity that was referred to. So I appreciate these amendments that are being proposed in order to provide us the opportunity to reduce parking for projects where it makes sense. And I agree with Michael that it's really the management of the property that's key. You know, you can have parking standards that dictate a certain number of parking spaces, but that isn't necessarily going to be the golden ticket to ensuring there's adequate parking. You know, restaurants, for example, I think parking demand has more to do with how good the food is than anything else related to that particular restaurant. So there's a lot of varying factors, as well as in these residential projects. So the amendments, I appreciate being able to provide that opportunity to reduce parking where it's warranted.
Thanks, Hillary. That's helpful for me.
I appreciate those comments. Those were, I agree with all of that.
Yes. Other APC members on this topic?
Mr. Chair, I've got a comment.
Go ahead, Kevin.
This is Kevin. Hi there. I mostly wanted to echo some of Jason's comments, as well as Crystal's, and support Ellery's as well. I think this project is the right project, the right site, the right time. And in terms of parking, I think our models of transportation are changing rapidly. And, well, to not get too futuristic, I think now's the time to look for opportunities to skinny up our parking. And this project is a good example of one where we can do that. It meets the needs of the project and can keep a good project moving quickly. I think ongoing monitoring versus significant upfront parking requirements for individual projects is where we need to be moving and looking at it with a regional approach. So I just wanted to get that on the record and say I also strongly support the project and the amendments that are proposed.
Thanks, Kevin. Other APC members?
I had one additional, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Steve.
Thank you. The other thing I wanted to point out for the record is that this project is a high priority for the city's housing plan. It was identified as a high priority project in the South Shore Housing Action Plan that came out of the South Shore Housing Needs Assessment. And so it is consistent with the goals of affordable housing for the South Shore. And so I think that's one of the reasons why it's a high priority for the state of California and under Senate Bill 35. And I think that, as Mr. Drake said, sort of bears on our decision to move this forward in a timely way and to, you know, think in terms of skinnying up the parking, as he said, which I think could be done in a number of areas, but certainly for affordable housing projects. And as Ms. Roverud mentioned, a good example is right across the street at Sierra Gardens.
Thanks, Steve. Any other member comments? Okay, let me now go ahead and open this up for public comment. So to participate in the meeting, once again, go to trpa.org under the announcements header, click on Advisory Planning Commission meeting, December 9th, 2020, where you can find a link to the public webinar hosted on GoToWebinar. If any member of the public wishes to address the APC, please use the hand-raising function now and you'll be unmuted by a TRPA staff member. I'll turn this over to Catherine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First up, Mia Kang. I have unmuted you, and then also unmute yourself, and you can address the APC.
Great. Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Michael, for really an excellent presentation. I was very impressed by the graphics, I have to say. And the detail. And thank you, APC members, for all of your, you know, very, very poignant input. And I want to thank everyone for their forward thinking. As everyone might know, I'm the developer for Sugar Pine Village, and this project is a culmination of a series of focus group meetings and active participation and coordination with TRPA, the City of Southlake, Hillary's staff, as well as CTC and the state. And you know, really, we're trying to take advantage of, as everyone knows, SB 35 to be able to make the governor's initiative timeline to be able to break ground in 2 years. But we also get to really demonstrate how we can be thinking about sustainability and resiliency around providing new housing in town centers. And so we very much applaud all the work that's been done to date with the Tahoe Valley Area Plan, the density and the height that's prescribed. And these tweaks are really just, in our mind, sort of necessary in order to take full advantage of the existing zoning that's present on the site, i.e. density and height. The parking, as discussed, I wanted to stress, there was a parking study that was submitted, and our plan exceeds the study recommendation, which looks at Sierra Garden and other projects, including another project I worked on in Kings Beach, which also had reduced parking. And to Ms. Roverud's point earlier, these projects being deed restricted affordable require a considerable amount of oversight and on-site property management. For this particular project, we'll have 3 on-site management staff available 24/7. So, you know, there will always be people on site to make sure that the program and the plans are in place are followed. But I also want to stress that we are located on Lake Tahoe Boulevard, which is home to the new Class 1 bike trail. So the big focus of this project is multimodal transportation. And so we are including several multi-use trails through the property to allow for the public to go through the property via pedestrian or bicycle. And also, not only do we have sort of smart transportation with regards to parking, but we're also looking at minimum 2 indoor secured bike parking spaces per unit, in addition to lots of bike secured parking outdoors. So we really are encouraging multimodal activation, and we are looking at a variety of other parking management plan strategies to bring forward to hopefully pilot on what could be, I think, the future of the region, which gets people out of cars and enjoying the great region of Tahoe in ways that can get us around without using a vehicle. So again, thank you for your support on this project. And I really want to thank staff for how quick and how expeditious and expertly they've worked through these amendments. So thank you again, everyone involved.
Thank you, Mia.
Next up, Chase Janbrin. I've unmuted you, and then also unmute yourself.
Great, thank you. Good morning, TRPA Advisory Planning Commission, and thank you for your time today. I'm Chase Janbrin, the Program Manager for the Tahoe Prosperity Center. I'd like to voice our support for the proposed amendments to the Tahoe Valley Area Plan. For decades now, new, high-quality, and especially affordable developments have been hampered by building restrictions that have been difficult to adhere to. We have a unique opportunity in this project to build a truly impactful, affordable housing development with the Sugar Pine Village project. And due to the direction from the state and cooperation from the California Tahoe Conservancy, and we applaud TRPA's continued commitment to making affordable workforce housing a priority and being willing to review some of these types of restrictions in the name of progress. As I understand today, the proposed changes really fall into three categories: the allowance of soft coverage to be transferred to a project, reducing a roof coverage requirement that is primarily aesthetic in nature, and of course, the ability to reduce parking requirements when the appropriate studies show that it's feasible. We think these are worthy changes to our existing area plan in exchange and for allowance for the providing of housing for our local workforce. So thank you for your focus and commitment to these issues, and keep up the great work.
Thanks, Chase.
Mr. Chair, there are no other hands raised to make public comment.
Okay, thank you, Catherine. I'll bring it back to APC. Any additional comments from APC members?
This is Bruce Grego again.
Go ahead, Bruce.
I have a question. Hi. What if the parking proves inadequate? What mechanism do we have to correct the matter after the project is built?
Michael?
If the parking proves inadequate, what mechanisms
do we have to correct the situation?
Okay. I mean,
can we impose on the developer or, of the project to develop more parking spaces if the management's inadequate or the needs are greater than expected? What is the mechanism for correcting the situation if the studies do not support the reality of what occurs at the property?
If the monitoring finds that there is a parking problem being created, what could we do?
Yes.
Well, first of all, it would be built into the agreement that's recorded on the deed restriction. So there would be mechanisms built into there, and that could be things like requiring additional offsite parking be acquired or developed, or like a shared parking agreement be done with the neighboring property owner, something of that nature.
Have other projects that you are familiar with proved that parking was inadequate and the developer was compelled to take other actions to correct the problem? Have you seen that happen any place in the basin based on your experiences?
Not in the basin. I'm relatively new to the basin. I've only been here about 2 years. I can think of it in my past career, but I can't think of an example locally.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bruce. Other comments from APC members? Okay. We have two motions that are required for this item. Approval requires an affirmative vote of the majority of the quorum. Would any APC member like to take on the first motion that's included in our packet?
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to make a motion. This is Hillary Roverud.
Thank you, Hillary. Go ahead.
I'll go with the first one. Make a motion that the APC recommend governing board approval of the required findings, including a finding of no significant effect, for adoption of the draft amendments to the Tahoe Valley Area Plan and as provided in Attachment D of our staff report.
I'll be a second, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Hillary and Steve. Any further discussion? Okay, Tracy, can we do a roll call vote, please?
Mr. Alling? Mr. Booth? Mr. Calicrete?
Yes.
Mr. Comba?
Yes.
Mr. Gavon?
Yes.
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Plemmel?
Yes.
Ms. Stala?
Aye.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Mr. Young?
Yes.
Mr. Drake?
Yes.
Oh, thank you. Mr. Drew?
Yes.
Mr. Grego?
Because of my concerns regarding the parking issue and the fact that we really don't have a recourse if the parking plan turns to be out inadequate, I very much support this project, but I vote no.
Ms. Jacobson?
Yes.
Mr. Letton?
Yes.
Ms. Roverud?
Yes.
Mr. Smokey? And Mr. Ferry?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, that motion passes.
Thank you, Tracy. We also have a second motion. Hillary, would you like to go ahead with that one too?
Sure, no problem. I'll make a motion that the APC recommend to the Governing Board adoption of Ordinance 2020-number TBD, amending Ordinance 2015-05 as previously amended to amend the Tahoe Valley Area Plan to include the changes referenced in Attachment H of our staff report.
I'll be the second again, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Hillary and Steve. Any further discussion? Okay, Tracy, another roll call vote, please.
Okay. Mr. Smokey? Ms. Roverud?
Yes.
Mr. Letton?
Yes.
Ms. Jacobson?
Yes.
Mr. Grego?
For the same reasons I've already expressed, I vote no.
Mr. Drew?
Yes.
Mr. Drake?
Yes.
Mr. Young?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Ms. Stala?
Aye.
Mr. Plemmel?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Gavon?
Yes.
Mr. Comba?
Yes.
Mr. Calicrate?
Yes.
Mr. Booth? Mr. Orling? Mr. Chair, that motion also carries.
Thank you, Tracy. I vote yes, too. I'm not sure if I was, I don't think I went, but just so it's clear.
Sorry, thank you.
That's okay. Okay, thank you all for that. That wraps up item 5. Congratulations to the city and the developers for moving one step closer. Let's move on to item 6, which is planning matters. Item 6A is a briefing on the 2019 threshold evaluation and TRPA's digital first initiative. Information on this item can be found on page 141 of your packet. And I'm now going to turn this over to Ken Caseman with TRPA to present on this item.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the Advisory Planning Commission. I'm Ken Caseman. I'm the Research and Analysis Division Manager at TRPA. The RNA team does a lot of things, and today I'm going to talk about some changes that we're making to TRPA's systems and processes as part of the Digital First initiative that's discussed in detail in the work program. We'll also talk about some changes that we're making to the upcoming threshold evaluation. And next, Sean Tevlin will talk about the monitoring work that TRPA does and how it supports management action in the region and provides the basis for the threshold evaluations. We'll also discuss the latest work on stream environment zones that will set up the threshold update for SEZs. So what is the Digital First Initiative? In short, it's an organization-wide, multi-year evaluation and rethinking of TRPA's technology and systems to proactively reimagine how we use technology, drive efficiency, innovation and creativity, and how we automate our processes to become a more connected, more streamlined, efficient, and paperless agency. And it's about how we use these digital tools, our technology and data to solve problems, simplify how we find, analyze, and share information, and how we collaborate internally and externally. This work started years ago. The agency created the Research Analysis Division in 2013, and the agency's 2014 strategic plan included two key pillars, one, to operate as a high-performance organization, and two, to use the best information, data, and science for decision-making and accountability. Technology and data systems build capacity for our staff, our partners, and the public to better plan and to achieve and maintain thresholds more effectively and efficiently. As part of the Digital First Initiative, we're evaluating all of our information resources, from maps to case files to numeric data and images, from our internal systems for staff to user and customer-facing tools, and our regional collaborative platforms like Lake Tahoe Info. TRP is well positioned for this digital transformation, and I'm highlighting our work in a couple of areas and divisions today, but this initiative spans the agency, and we could just as easily highlight digital first work, for example, in finance with our e-contracting, or HR with paperless onboarding, or long-range planning with modernizing and connecting our code. The digital transformation is a buzzword. It means many different things to different people. For us, it means digitizing the 50 plus years of our paper records and the data entry to bring this valuable information into our systems for analysis. It's digitalizing our systems and processes and converting agency practices, creating new records electronically, connecting our databases and information platforms, and automating and streamlining our processes, and ultimately transforming our agency practices and framing them in a digital first way. In R&A, we dedicated staff to converting our existing documents. We began by digitizing the agency's records and entering data and uncovering the information contained in them, and using the Lake Tahoe Info platform and the EIP tracker and the parcel tracker. And since 2013, all issued permits are digitized and all data is entered into our systems before they go out the door. And we've scanned more than 12,000 project files, updated information on more than 25,000 parcels, and responded to more than 1,000 requests for parcel information to be updated in the system. Now, years ago, we saw the need to change how we do business, and we started the transition to electronic submittals and permitting. And when COVID hit, we accelerated our digital transition. We transformed the way we do business, expanding electronic submittals, reviews, and permitting, accepting and using electronic signatures, and holding virtual meetings, town halls, and webinars. And because of our IT investments over the past several years, nearly all of our staff already had laptops and phone equipment that supported remote work. And our core systems are internet accessible or cloud-based, and we offer secure direct access to TRPA's network from home. There's a lot from this year that we want to all forget, but there are also many things that we've learned and done that we want to continue post-pandemic. Now, prior to COVID, we had 8 applications available for electronic submittal using our Citizens Access site. We can move on to the next slide, please, Tracy. When COVID closures were put in place, we immediately pivoted to prioritizing customer service through these tools. And today, on the next slide, we offer 33 different application types for electronic submittal. If we move on, our current planning team didn't miss a beat. Here in the picture, we have Brandy, Matt, Robbie, Bridget, Teresa, Steve, Allie, Bruce, Julie, Paul, Judy, Tiffany, Wendy, Casey, Rachel, Brendan, and Taylor. Over the last several years, applications to TRPA have increased, and 2020 was even higher. Through the third quarter, applications are up 13% in 2020 compared to 2019. Project applications are up 33%. And in fact, we took in more project applications in the first three quarters of this year than we did in all of 2016 and 2017. And we process another 100 qualified exempt declarations not included in these numbers. Our planners have received more than 3,000 phone calls this year, a 40% increase. And electronic submittals, represented in blue in the bottom chart, skyrocketed to nearly three quarters of all applications submitted during the third quarter of 2020. Electronically submitted project applications more than doubled since the beginning of COVID, and 60% of our verification and banking applications were submitted electronically last quarter. And these were only made available starting in March. Our tree removal applications continue to be a shining example of electronic submittal, review, and permitting. In the third quarter, 93% were submitted electronically, and all of the more than 12,000 tree removal applications this year were reviewed and permits issued electronically. Our field inspectors are another key highlight with the digital transition. Using connected iPads and the ability to add photos for inspections like pre-grade and final, and being able to access scanned project files and site plans from the field, the compliance team completed over 2,100 inspections this season using photos, virtual meetings, and field inspections in a safe way. They inspected and investigated more than 100 complaints and processed 200 grading season exceptions. On the next slide, along the way, we've had some positive and negative lessons learned, and we're happy to share some best practices. We found that once you get there, electronic reviews can be much more efficient. Everything's in one place and you can review everything together and it works really well. Also, there's significant time savings for staff by not having to enter applications into the system or process payments, and for applicants who can avoid their trips to the office, save paper and time, and vehicle trips. And on the back end, with digital processing, there's no need to scan documents at the end. Everything's already electronic. And we learned it's important to document your processes and workflows, the file routing, and to plan how files will be handled once they're received. And it's critical to have electronic stamps and e-signature capabilities. Electronic permitting cannot be done without them. And we already had these developed pre-COVID, so we were ahead of the game. We also created a Google document to manage incoming applications and assignments, so nothing fell through the cracks. It takes time to manage and train your staff and customers, and developing guides can be helpful for complex steps within your application process. We also found that many applications will come in incomplete. There are missing signature pages or other required information. So providing the flexibility for staff to add missing items is important. And also, not everyone will use the electronic submittal or e-payment. And so we offer a Dropbox for some to leave paper applications at our office if they don't want to use our electronic tools. We've also found that security deposits and returns are still being done by check today because of some limitations in processing those. You want to make sure to coordinate with your technical staff and plan the rollout. And also use the opportunity to rethink your applications and other documentation. Don't just replicate the paper forms, but think about how you would create them from scratch in a digital world. I also want to highlight on the next slide the behind the scenes work that my team pictured here have done. The top row, Amy, Mason, and Emily, are our superstar GIS team, working to maintain our mapping systems and produce amazing web maps and story maps. Dan, Beth, Sean, and Reed are incredible with data collection and analysis for our field monitoring, which Sean will talk about next, and for our transportation system. And Jean, Adele, Lori, and Linda provide support services to our planning teams, responding to customer inquiries and scanning requested files. They are at the core of our digitization and digitalization work that we've talked about, electronic submittals, file scanning, and parcel information updates. And they're leading the extraordinary work in developing Lake Tahoe Info. Now, speaking of Lake Tahoe Info, I'd like to spend some time talking about where we are and our plans for the next threshold evaluation. As many of you know, Lake Tahoe Info started originally with the EIP project tracker. and following the failures of the earlier TIM system that tried to be everything for everybody, we took a different approach. We started small and focused and built each piece modularly and built and moved at the speed of trust. Then, as opportunity and funding arose, we continued to build the platform organically. Over the past several years, we've been investing to expand the services and to maintain and update the existing tools provided on site to keep them relevant. For example, the EIP tracker was completely overhauled this year to coincide with the EIP update and the new action priorities of the EIP. As you may know, TRPA also took a novel approach and placed an open source license on the EIP tracker and the stormwater tools, which allows other agencies to access the source code for these tools and to develop their own software programs. These agencies are able to quickly use the tools and save significant time and cost compared to developing their own software. And in exchange, TRPA receives new features from the investments that our licensees put into the platform. The open source tool is named Project Firma. And today, there are 9 agencies in 5 states actively using the platform and a few prospective new ones in the pipeline. On the next slide, we can see some of these instances that include local and regional sites like the Clackamas Partnership and Puget Sound Partnership, statewide tools like the California Resource Conservation District Project Tracker, and the Washington Forest Health Tool, as well as the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation Endangered Species Act Project Tracker for the Columbia River Basin. Together, our licensees have invested more than $3 million in developing their tools and in enhancing the platform. And TRPA has received nearly $90,000 in functionality back into the EIP tracker and stormwater tools as a result of the open source licenses. We also licensed the overall Lake Tahoe Info platform to Puget Sound Partnership, which launched their version, Puget Sound Info, last year. And from all of this work, we've created a community of users, many who have modeled their programs after the Lake Tahoe EIP. And we meet quarterly, usually with 20 to 30 representatives from current and prospective community members, to discuss progress on individual initiatives, to learn from each other and identify collective goals, and to plan future enhancements to these tools. As we've continued to work on the LT Info, the EIP Tracker, and Project Firma, in the Tahoe region, we continue to recognize the need to connect the partnership's actions and accomplishments to the indicator monitoring data and to our goals in environmental health for the region, to better analyze the outcomes of our work and to better understand the effect that the EIP and TRPA's permitting actions have had. Now, every 4 years, TRPA leads the development of a threshold evaluation that assesses the ecosystem health relative to the adopted standards. It's the evaluation that documents the region's progress towards achieving our shared goals. TRPA will release the 7th comprehensive threshold evaluation in early 2021. The reporting process draws on the monitoring work and expertise of federal, state, and local agencies, academic institutions, and local businesses and private consultants. It provides a comprehensive overview of the environmental health of the region, as indicated by the more than 150 standards and 9 threshold categories. The evaluation will look very differently this year from the reports of the past. Gone are the 1,000-page PDFs and endless appendices. The evaluation will take its cues from TRPA's Digital First initiative and will be an online interactive dashboard representing the best practice in informing the public, decision makers, and stakeholders. And as we move into this digital era, we believe this format will be much better and much more digestible, making the information more accessible and meaningful, and better linking regional actions to outcomes. I'll walk through an example of the new nested format of the evaluation. It allows stakeholders to see the results at a high level and then to drill down into the detailed data if desired. First, at the threshold category level, here we see an example from the wildlife category. Then, on the next slide, at the reporting category level, here for special interest species, then the specific threshold, in this case for Peregrine Falcon. And here we see more information about the standard, as well as the detailed status and trend information, then detailed findings and key results, and an interactive map of evaluation sites in the region. And we'll do this for all 150 threshold standards. And at the bottom, we link to the monitoring program detail page for even more information about the Peregrine Falcon population monitoring program and examples of EIP projects that relate to this threshold standard. The monitoring detail pages provide an even more detailed discussion of the monitoring approach and our partner that perform those monitoring efforts, as well as links to documents, in this case, the detailed survey protocols and associated indicators for Peregrine monitoring program. So as you can see, how the interactive nature of the new site and the nested information enables stakeholders to get as little or as much detail as they want. And again, the threshold evaluation and dashboard will be released in early 2021. And while we do not have yet specific details to share, we have talked many times about the fact that long-term progress is slow. Incremental progress towards attainment has been reported in each of the previous six threshold evaluations, and we anticipate that this one will show the same. At the same time, the threshold will also call out some areas in need of focused work and some areas of uncertainty as we face the future in response to changing climatic conditions. And with that, I thank you for your time. This is an informational item, so no action is required, but I'd be happy to take any questions that you have.
Thank you, Ken. Very informative, tons of information, and it always pleases me to see TRPA continue to innovate and move to a digital world. I use LT Info constantly. I'm really excited about the threshold evaluation, the new procedures with that. That's great stuff. And APC members, let's see, anyone like to comment or have questions for Ken?
Hi, Brendan. This is Eric. May I?
Go ahead, Eric.
Thank you. Ken, as usual, that was really great. Thank you so much. And I, like Brendan, I appreciate the willingness of TRPA to stretch the envelope, but not only that, but to be so partnership-oriented and collaborative-oriented, not only with us around the basin, but clearly with other partners who are facing similar issues around the country. It's important to be part of those kinds of things, and I just want to let you know I appreciate how much effort you put into being a partner around the country, as well as just in the basin. My question about the last few slides, they're wonderful. It's a great new approach, but it looks to me like something that generates more questions. I mean, if somebody goes in and looks at that, it's great stuff and it answers questions, but it also, it looks like the kind of thing that people might look at and go, oh, well, I have a question. So maybe I just missed it, but is there a spot on there where you click on additional information or how to contact an agency to ask a question or to contact a human being with just to make touch? I mean, I love what you're doing, but the first thing that happens to me is, and maybe it's just me, but I'm like, oh my gosh, I have a question. What do people like me do in that case? So thank you, Ken. I'm done.
Certainly. So, you know, in response, you know, throughout Lake Tahoe Info, I think one of the cornerstone elements of the site is that we offer links and opportunities for people to request support, whether it's, as I mentioned, you know, in our parcel tracker, ways that they can reach out and ask us to update information, or within the threshold evaluation, we will have opportunities in the dashboard where if somebody does have a question, they can reach out to us and it'll automatically email our team, and we can respond to those questions. We will also, in addition to the dashboard, we will produce an executive summary report that will be, you know, a synthesized version of the threshold information, and we'll provide a little bit more context. So we will have that report available as well as likely a story map that walks through in more detail using kind of the, as I've done in this presentation, more visuals, so pictures and videos and other tools to tell the story in a more comprehensive way. So I think we'll offer a wide range of opportunities for stakeholders to engage with this information beyond just the dashboard. But we think that the dashboard will be much more accessible than, as I said, in the past, you know, a 1,000-page PDF document.
It's a really well done. I think all of your partners locally and nationally are going to be pleased with what this offers us. So thank you.
Thank you.
Other APC members.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Steve, go ahead.
Thank you, sir. Ken, I concur with my colleague's outstanding presentation and really commend the agency for thinking forward. And as somebody that has struggled through lots of pages of threshold evaluations in the past, I'm particularly excited about the streamlined approach to thresholds, which I think will make the information more accessible. And maybe some people will look at the information that may not have in the past because they were overwhelmed by the documentation. So, you know, it is great for all of your partners in the basin, including those of us in the private sector. You're setting a good pace for how to move into the digital age. And as others have said, you know, what you're doing with other similar organizations around the country is also very commendable. So thank you.
Thanks, Steve. Other members?
Brendan, if I can.
Yes, Crystal.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Ken, for the great presentation. I just wanted to say that I really appreciate TRP's collaboration, and I really love and appreciate the sort of dedication to transparency, and that really like the threshold dashboard. I think that it's really forward-facing, and just I like the idea that it just puts the information out there and it's available at the fingertips. So thank you very much for your effort.
Thank you.
Yep, agreed. Who else? Anyone?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, go ahead.
Hi, this is Kevin, Kevin Hill. Ken, great job on your presentation. And just want to say, as a contributor to the first three threshold evaluations back in the day, I really am thrilled to see where the agency is headed. One thing that's I've always been interested in, I know the agency has put a high priority on, is translating this data and information into decision making and policy, potential policy changes. I'm wondering if you have maybe some examples or maybe the process of how this information gets looped back into decision making.
Absolutely. I think that, I think I can talk to it a little bit. And actually, the next presentation, Sean Tevlin will be walking through some of our specific monitoring programs and some of the connections to management actions that have already resulted from some of the data that we're seeing. So I may defer to the next presentation on that. But I think that one of the core elements of the four-year threshold evaluation is just that, you know, using that information to then go back and evaluate the regional plan and our policies to see, are there other things that we can or should be doing, or are there areas, whether it's projects in the EIP that should be prioritized, other ways that we can better use this information to address areas that we're out of attainment in, or to continue to maintain, you know, the current environmental standards. So I think that it's an important element of the threshold evaluation, and one that we certainly will be looking to do. And I think that's, again, the benefit of the dashboard that we're putting together is being able to better connect that and be able to see the specific EIP projects that are already programmed that address certain thresholds, or to click into the specific monitoring data and see the effect of those projects that have been implemented, or areas where if there's a particular standard that is lower than we'd like it to be, to look at those proposed projects in the EIP that can then address those deficiencies and hopefully bring forward environmental improvement. So I think that, you know, that's really the goal. And, you know, the EIP is the implementation effort of, you know, attaining and maintaining thresholds. And so I think by connecting everything together, it really provides that holistic and end-to-end view of, you know, actions and outcomes.
Great. Thank you so much, Ken. And I agree. I think the when you see the data and you can drill down to see what a problem is, then I agree with you, is that there's some EIP projects or some approach that might be able to address that more specifically. So thank you for your comments and your presentation.
Thanks, Kevin. Mr. Letton has a comment, question.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. Great presentation, Ken. I work for the Lahontan Water Board. Actually, my question is more about who I can contact with some further questions I have about Project Firma. Would that be you or somebody else?
Yeah, you can certainly reach out to me and I can put you in contact as well. Gene McNamara on my team is our lead for Lake Tahoe Info overall. But yeah, we can certainly put you in contact with our developers at Sika Technology Group in Portland that have, you know, worked with us for several years on the implementation and development of Lake Tahoe Info.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have any comments relative to the 2019 threshold evaluation and TRPA's digital first initiative. It's application of Project Firma and the platform outside of the basin, actually, because our Lahontan region extends all the way from Oregon down to the Mojave Desert. So it's another project, but I see that, you know, it looks like you guys are expanding it out, you know, a lot of areas. So I'm interested to discuss that further. And that's all, Chair. Thank you for your presentation.
Thanks, Ben. Any other APC members? Okay. Let me open this up to public comment. So once again, to participate in the meeting, go to trpa.org. Under the announcements header, click on APC meeting December 9, 2020. There you'll find a link to the public webinar. And if any member of the public wishes to address the APC, please use the hand raising function now and you'll be unmuted by a staff member.
Mr. Chair, I see no hands raised to make public comment at this time.
Thanks, Catherine. Okay, any final comments from anyone? Okay, that was information only. Thanks again, Ken, we appreciate it. Let's move on to item 6B, which is a 2020 monitoring program update. Information on this item can be found on page 143 of your packet. And I'm now gonna turn this over to Sean Tevlin to present on this item. Hey, Sean.
Hey, how you doing? I'm just making sure this is all ready to go. Can everybody see my screen?
Yes, we can.
All right. So thank you, everybody. I'm Sean Tevlin, environmental specialist here at TRPA. So I run our field monitoring programs, and today I'm going to talk about some of the highlights from our 2020 field season. And what I'm going to focus on, like Ken talked about in one of the comments, was is really how our data goes into making management decisions. I think we talk a lot about monitoring data, and even with the previous thing about parking, we talk about the monitoring, but we don't always talk about how it actually goes into management decisions, which is probably the most important part. So that is what I'll focus on today. So 2020 was a summer like no other for everybody, including our little field team. So we had to implement COVID protocols, you know, 6 feet in, 6 feet of distance, masking when necessary, separate vehicles, things like that. But because we were able to implement these safety protocols, we were able to get out in the field and do work when many others were unable to. So we want to thank TRP management for letting us do that. And we were able to complete all the work necessary. And we even took over some work from our partners who were unable to get in the field for some really critical data sets that we didn't want to miss out on this year. So I'll go over some of the highlights from all the things we gathered this year, which is wildlife, noise, air quality, bicycle, pedestrian, tile, yellowcrest, streams, and stream environment zones. I'll go through like basics for each one and then a highlight from each category. The stream environment zones will take up the last half of the presentation because that's like its own special project that I'll highlight. So in terms of wildlife, so we're in charge. We have several special interest species that TRPA has to report on, and we are directly in charge of osprey, bald eagle, and peregrine falcon monitoring. So for osprey, nesting numbers are steady, nothing really exciting to report there. Same thing with bald eagles. There was a new nest at Camp Richardson, which is the first new successful nest we've had in years, so that's exciting. But the main thing I want to focus on is the peregrine falcon story, which they continue to make recovery. You can see at the bottom here, you know, up to 2008, there was 50 plus years of no peregrine falcons in the basin. They were thought to be extinct. Over the last 12 years, now we're up to 5 active nests. In this past year, the big highlight was working with the climbing and hiking community to reduce impacts at Castle Rock. So because of our monitoring over the past several years, we had noticed as Castle Rock up on the Tahoe Rim Trail off Kingsbury, as it became more and more popular, the nest was being disturbed and it actually led to multiple nest failures. So we worked with our partners on a really detailed monitoring plan, worked with the hiking and climbing communities, and we were able to post signage out there last year and this year as well. And because of the signage and because of our outreach, people actually did stay away from the rock during the critical nesting season. Because of this, the last 2 years, we've had success, or the birds had success, hopefully with our help. So this is a really good example of where our monitoring data went into a management decision. In this case, it was a successful outcome. So you can see the picture of one of the signs at Castle Rock, and we had, you know, signage everywhere out there during the nesting season. And there's also a little newspaper clipping there from the San Francisco Chronicle. There was at least 6 or 7 different, you know, TV and newspaper stories about the success of this project this year. So it's kind of a feel-good story. In terms of noise, so we have to do standard noise monitoring in plan areas and highways every year. So we had 40 different noise monitors installed this year. Nothing really too exciting to report there. The more exciting part is the increased noise monitoring for shore zone enforcement. So this is the second year of the shoreline plan implementation. A big part of that plan was to reduce the impacts from noisy boats. So we were able to work with the boat crew this year with our monitoring equipment to identify 38 likely noise violators, which is the most we've ever been able to actually identify. And the enforcement team is working, sending out notices to these owners that basically say you either need to come into compliance with your noise levels or you're not welcome back on the lake. So you can see the number of noise exceedances for 2020. It was higher than 2019, lower than 2017. We haven't seen the monitoring data response yet from these efforts. But it's only the second year of implementation. We hope as more and more boats are taken off the lake or brought into compliance that these noise exceedances are going to be reduced. But this is, again, another good example of our monitoring data going into a management decision. So for air quality, we continued our regular maintenance and operation of multiple air quality sites around the basin. So we monitor 5 different pollutants, things like ozone, particulate matter, visibility. The 2 main takeaways this year are, so overall trends continue to get better. You can see the annual average for particulate matter at one of the South Lake Tahoe sites going back to the 80s. The overall trends are getting better, and this is common for many of the pollutants in the basin. On the other end is that extreme events are getting worse from fires outside the basin. So you can see here, this is like the maximum daily air quality index at our site at Incline Village. And you can see 2020 numbers were higher, the highest they've been at least in the last 7 years. And that's even, you know, if you remember 2013 and 2014, we had the Rim Fire, the King Fire, really bad air quality, but nothing compared to what we saw in 2020. So that's really the story, is overall trends continue to get better, but the extreme events based on fires from really outside the basin continue to get worse. And that is, you know, problematic. You can see a photo here of one of our air quality filters, I think taken in early September from Lake Tahoe Community College. You can just see how bad that that particulate matter was. You can only imagine what it's like inside your lungs. And in terms of how this goes into management decisions, there's nothing that you can do immediately to stop forest fires or anything, or to stop these extreme events. But it just really, I think, highlights the importance of our continued forest health initiative. So there's so many reasons that forest health is important. Air quality is another one of those reasons. On to bicycle pedestrians. So we manage 20 plus counties around the basin. We're actually up to, I believe, 30 now. We've hit the 30 mark. And the story for 2020 is that despite COVID, 2020 counts were actually very similar to 2019 counts. So you can see up here, this is the combined numbers for all sites in the basin. Summer 2020 was actually less busy than 2019. Fall 2020, however, that tourism did not really drop off. It is much more busy than fall 2019. And then there's big differences depending on where the counting sites were. So overall, the South Shore was less busy. So you can see here, Pioneer Trail at State Line, that's actually our busiest counter in the whole basin. It gets all the workers going to Heavenly Village and the casinos, tourists as well. Those numbers for 2020 were about half of those in 2019. So a lot of our urbanized sites were much less busy. However, you go to pretty much every site on the North Shore, including the Truckee River Trail, which is a little less urban, it was much more busy in 2020 than it was in 2019. So there's kind of differences throughout the basin, but overall 2020 counts were actually pretty similar to 2019. In terms of how this data is used by to make management decisions, is especially this year, this data was used by recreation partners to manage recreation sites. We've had this program going for 3 or 4 years now, and this year we had so many requests for data, and the data was presented at so many different meetings in terms of how do we manage crowds at recreation sites, things like that, given the COVID situation. And another really important part about how this data is being used for management decisions is the data is being used to make the case for more bike trail investments. So as this program grows, we're getting a lot of good before and after data. And for 2020, the best data came from the Meeks Bay Trail, which was completed at the very end of 2019, the segment from Sugar Pine to Meeks Bay. So before that new path was built, that section saw about 6,000 users per day. 2020, after the trail was completed, up about 24,000. So 400% increase. And we have those numbers more and more for sites around the basin. It really gives the story of why bike trails are good investments. And just to go on what Ken had talked about in terms of the digital transformation of TRPA, all the data I'm talking about today, including the bike and pedestrian data, is on our monitoring dashboard that's accessible to the public. It's not some internal TRPA database that no one else can see. And this is just an example. That some screenshots pulled from the monitoring dashboard. You can go to any bicycle pedestrian site in the basin. You can click on it. You can see where it's located. You can see images of it, and you can actually see all the data for as long as it's been in use. And this data is updated once a month. So this is all part of that digital transformation. On to Tahoe Yellowcrest. So we do a survey once a year to determine the overall population. We do this with our partners. So 2020, there was a really big lack of partner staff to do the surveys. So usually the Forest Service is in charge of leading the survey. Because of COVID, because of the forest fires in September, when we do the survey, they were unable to help at all. So TRPA, other partners needed to step up. We were able to step up and complete the surveys. And basically what we found in 2020 is that the numbers continue to be pretty low, mostly due to high lake levels. So as you can see in the graph down here, 2020 was the lowest number since 2000. But that's not necessarily any alarm bells, because it's also, as you can see, the lake level here, this blue line, the lake level has been very high for a while. So it's not too unexpected that the numbers are where they are. They're actually better than they were the last time the lake was this high for this long. But because how this impacts management, the monitoring into management, is the low numbers that we've seen actually trigger actions under the Tahoe Yellow Crest Management Plan that we've all signed on to, the partners in the basin. So it required some additional fencing around, you know, core sites like at Nevada Beach. The Forest Service was required to put in, improve their fencing there to protect that site. Then also some like homeowner outreach. We saw during our surveys, recreation impacts were really bad this year. At least anecdotally speaking, a lot of these, in September, we usually go to these places and there's not really much action going on. A lot of these homeowner beaches this year, you know, you can see from this picture, there's lawn chairs on top of the Yellow Crest. People, everybody was home. And so this really intensified the recreation impacts of Tahoe Yellow Crest. In terms of streams, so we have a bioassessment program, which is basically monitoring macroinvertebrates, the bugs that live in the stream, to look at the overall biotic health of the stream. We continued our normal bioassessment monitoring in 2020. We had about 40 sites. And the main story of bioassessment is the monitoring is being used more and more by project partners to assess restoration effectiveness and project impacts. So, for example, we have sites with the Forest Service now at a lot of their fuel reduction projects to ensure that there's no negative biotic impacts to the biotic health of the stream based on the fuel reduction project. And then also when projects complete restoration sites on streams, they're using our data more and more to show before and after. And what we're seeing, like in 2020, we sampled about 7 sites on past restoration sites. 6 were in the very healthy category. So it's another good way to show restoration effectiveness and turn that modern data into actually help inform management decisions. So before I go into stream environment zones, I'm going to stop there. And are there any questions on the first part of that presentation?
Any questions for Sean?
Okay.
Sean, I think you can keep rolling.
All right. So for stream environment zones, when I talk about SEZ monitoring, I'm talking about meadows, marshes, wetlands, riparian areas, fens, and streams. So it includes streams, but it's much larger than just the streams. So in 2020, we completed a 3-year project that assessed the current SEZ conditions across the entire Tahoe Basin, and we're calling this the SEZ Baseline Condition Assessment. And how this monitoring data is going to be used into management is the results are being used to set a new science-based SEZ threshold. So you've probably heard about how we're updating some of our thresholds. The SEZ one is one of those ones we're updating. So this data is going to go directly into making that science-based SEZ threshold update. So I'll give you a little bit of background on the SEZ monitoring assessment program. So after 2016, it became real clear that there was no basin-wide monitoring of SEZ. We simply report on the number of acres restored. Different partners, you know, would monitor restoration sites, but that's about it. We got a lot of criticism for this. We knew we needed to start a more robust program. So we were able to obtain an EPA grant in 2017 to help development of this program. As part of this grant, we initiated a technical advisory committee made up of a bunch of different partners in the basin, and we were able to bring in local experts to provide technical assistance developing this SEZ monitoring assessment program. And then the last 2 summers, TRPA staff have spent a lot of time out in the field gathering all the data needed to complete this SEZ baseline condition assessment. And again, how this all goes into management decisions is to set a new SEZ threshold. We need to understand the current SEZ conditions. So again, this SEZ baseline condition assessment is establishing those current SEZ conditions so we can set a new threshold. So the stakeholder process, we had a bunch of different partners involved, everyone from the Forest Service to the Nevada Resource Conservation District. We had four full group meetings since 2017 at all the major decision points. Even more importantly, is there's been countless individual meetings with partners since 2017. So now we're at a point where all partners agree on the results of this project, which is super important. So now I'll quickly go through the five steps we took to assess current SEZ conditions. So the first step, we had to agree on the most important functions SEZs provide. Things like reducing sediment, nutrient pollutant loading, moderating water temperature. Important functions like that, that's the first thing you need to agree on, what you're trying to protect and restore. Once you agree on those, we had to choose measurable indicators that relate to these important SEZ functions. So we start out with about 25 potential indicators. You can't measure all those, so we had to narrow it down to 10 of the most important ones. And you can see these condition indicators here, the ones that were chosen going forward. They range from things like head cuts to fish passage. So these were assessed for SEZ in the basin. Third step is actually choosing methods to measure those indicators. So a few things about methods. They need to be repeatable and feasible, given budget and staff restraints. So you can have the best monitoring plan in the world, but if you can't implement it, it's just going to sit on a shelf. So it had to be repeatable and feasible. Whenever possible, we utilize existing methods and protocols from other programs. So stream monitoring, wetland monitoring, meadow monitoring are not new science. So we tried not to reinvent the wheel and take from existing protocols whenever possible. Fourth step is actually going out and gathering the data. So there's hundreds of meadows and marshes in the Tahoe Basin, hundreds of miles of streams. So the question is, how do you measure them all? The most simple answer is a combination of field data and remotely sensed data. So new technology allows for remote sensing, which is basically measuring things from your desktop computer using technology that you used to have to go out in the field to measure. So it allows us to cover so much more areas with way less staff time and accomplish much more data collection. The second part is there's lots of existing SEZ data from partners. So some partners have studied certain SEZ sites throughout the basin really well. We don't need to go out and collect new data there. We can just incorporate their data into the overall project. And then the last step is going out and filling in any additional data gaps. And that's where TRPA staff spent the last two summers. So the final step is actually making sense of the data. So we know raw data on its own means very little. We've all seen giant databases, giant spreadsheets that never actually get put into action. So the data needs to give a meaning. Perspective. And the way that we did this is data was scored using an A, B, C, D rating system. And you can see an example here. You know, these are some of the different indicators, and you can see how they're put in the four different boxes, being very degraded, degraded, healthy, or very healthy. Depending on where your raw data lies, it goes into one of those four boxes. So then what you're left with is a scorecard for each SEZ in the basin. This is an example scorecard. You see the different indicators, a quick description of the indicator, the raw value associated with that indicator, the rating assigned to that raw value, and then the score is just, you know, an A equals a 12, B equals 9, C equals 6, D equals 3. You end up with an overall percentage for each SEZ in the basin, which now they all have. So the preliminary results, I'm still calling them preliminary because our partners actually have until this Friday to provide their final comments on any changes they'd like to see, but we've already gone through multiple reviews, so we don't expect any major changes. But what we have is the first ever condition assessment of SEZ on a basin-wide scale. So now we can assess the current conditions of SEZ on a basin-wide scale with actual scientific evidence. So in the past, there's numbers thrown out in the 80s about 25% of SEZs being degraded, things like that, but there was never a map associated with it, and there was never any actual like scientific evidence to back up how they came up with that number. We now have that. So we know that, for example, about 49% are very healthy, 23% are healthy, 8% are degraded, 17% are very degraded. And we can also look at things like long-term restoration effectiveness. So now we have the current conditions for sites that restored 10, 20, 30 years ago. So we can see if that current score reflects overall restoration effectiveness or if it's not functioning well anymore. And we can also look at things like where are the degraded SEZ in the basin. We have a map now that you can see every degraded SEZ in the basin. And again, how this modern data goes into management is this baseline condition assessment lays the groundwork for a science-based SEZ threshold update. And in terms of the digital transformation that Ken talked about, this is another example of that. This is our interactive SEZ web map where all the data lies. There's not some internal database that only TRP has access to. This is a public website. Our partners have used this to review all the data. You can click, go around, look at all SEZs in the basin. You can click on them. You get all the different data associated with the site. You can look at pictures of the site. You can look at comments, descriptions of the site, projects that have happened there, et cetera. And then finally, there's also a story map. So for people that don't want to read the 200-page report, you can just go to this public story map here, and it just basically takes you on a tour of all the major findings of this assessment. So again, part of that digital transformation. And that's really it. And now I'm open to any questions.
Very informative, Sean. That was really cool to see, I thought. And thank you so much for tying it back to management decisions. I think that really makes it applicable for us and for the public to see how this data is used, how it drives decisions, policies, etc. Super cool. I'm jealous. I wish I could go out in the field like that. How about APC members? Anyone have comments or questions for Sean? Eric, Gavon, you might have had something. Maybe not. Anyone have anything for Sean? Feedback?
Mr. Chair, Kevin Hill.
Go ahead, Kevin.
Sean, great presentation, and I echo Chair's comments of wanting to get out in the field again and do that great work you're doing. I'm just really impressed with how much the monitoring program has evolved and the data is available and usable. And thank you for providing many examples of how it's actually being used in decision-making. I appreciate that. So one question, back in the day, there was a few other things that were monitored, like stormwater and other lakes in the region, you know, Cascade, Fallen Leaf, Spooner, Merlet. Is that still occurring?
Yes. So this presentation really focused on what TRPA does internally with our, like, field crew. There's a lot of stuff that we contract with, so we have, like, the Tahoe Resource Conservation District monitors stormwater around the basin. You know, the USGS monitors the 7 different streams for, like, sediment concentrations and nutrient concentrations. So we have a bunch of different monitoring programs that we kind of pay other people to do, or they have, like, a grant to pay for it. So that stuff is all still ongoing, which we'll talk about the results in the threshold evaluation. Today I talked about the stuff that is really what TRPA does internally.
Great, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Eric Young.
Go ahead, Eric.
Howdy. Nice presentation again. Thank you so much. This is clearly just another example of how TRPA is continuing to push forward on a science-based approach and become the sort of the science-based organization that I think you may see yourselves as. It's really great. I appreciate it. The question that it brings to mind is I wonder if this may lead to a need for regional plan updates as you get better and clearer data. You know, new data always makes you look at things differently. So especially some of the stream environment zone monitoring things with the restoration, it sounds like we may actually be able to learn new things there. So over time, I'm not really asking you to tell us if you foresee any regional plan updates in the future, but as this continued science-based approach gets applied more and more, just just ask you to keep us informed of anything that you're seeing that may cause us to have to take a different turn, to do things differently, to approach something in a different manner than we are now, because you have better data than you did before. So that's all my input, but thank you so much for all the work you put into this.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the threshold evaluation's job. You know, the monitoring we do and other people do, it's all, the reason we do it is because of the threshold, so that every 4 years that changes like that to the regional plan that are necessary, that's where that would take place. That's like the official time for that, I think.
Makes sense. Who else has comments?
Mr. Chairman?
Steve, yes, go ahead, please.
Just principally to echo the comments that you, Mr. Hill, Mr. Young made about, you know, the importance of this presentation, the evolution of science-based planning at TRPA and working with many partners. So thank you, Sean. Really appreciated it.
Yep.
Yeah, Brendan, if I could chime in too. This is Crystal Jacobson again. Thank you, Sean. I really appreciate the presentation. And again, just appreciate the transparency.
Yes. Let's see. Any other APC members? Okay. Let me open this up to the public. So I'm going to repeat this statement one more time. To participate, please go to trpa.org. Under the announcements header, click on APC meeting December 9, 2020. There you'll find a link to the public webinar. And if any member of the public wishes to address the APC, please use the hand-raising function now and you'll be unmuted by a TRPA staff member.
Mr. Chair, we have no hands raised to make public comment on this item.
All right, thank you, Catherine. Ken, do you have something to add?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to take a moment. I wanted to thank Sean for the excellent presentation and also recognize Sean and his family have decided to leave the basin. And so this is Sean's swan song with the agency. He has been with us for 7.5 years and has led our monitoring program for over 5 years, including, you know, overhauling our monitoring program, taking the lead in the SEC grant that he just presented on, and initiated our annual monitoring report, which again summarizes the incredible work that our field team produces every year. And so I just wanted to take a moment to recognize Sean and thank him for his extraordinary service, and we wish him well.
Agreed. Thanks, Ken. Thank you, Sean, for your service. We really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks. Thanks, Ken. Thanks, all.
Did you find somewhere better than Tahoe to go?
Bend, Oregon. I think it's probably equal.
Uh-huh. It's a cool spot, too.
Yeah.
All right. We wish you well. Let's see. That concludes our informational items. Again, that one was only informational. We can now move on to item 7, which are our reports. I'm going to pass this to John Hester for our executive director report, which includes a quarterly report and upcoming topics.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. quarterly report is in the packet, so I won't go over that. A couple of comments on the comments you all made, Eric and Crystal and Steve and others. Collaboration, transparency, and what we call the adaptive management process, plan, do, check, adjust, are exactly what all of the information you saw was about. And we actually, you know, a lot of organizations have strategic plans and they all sound good. Ours actually has 4 strategic objectives or pillars. and they embrace using best science to accelerate threshold attainment. And so that's exactly what you're seeing, and we really appreciate your positive comments on that and want to reemphasize our commitment to collaboration, transparency, and using the best science. So thank you for that, and please hold our feet to the fire so that we live up to our strategic objectives. The only other thing I want to, the major upcoming topic I want to mention is we from staff really enjoy working with you all on the APC. As the APC, and when we work with you as individual organizations. And so 2020 has been a unique year that I hope we don't repeat anytime soon. We are all looking forward to a better 2021 and wish you all a happy holidays and a great 2021. And we're looking forward to working with you. So we'll have plenty of more detailed upcoming topics, but from staff to the APC members, we want to pass that on. So thank you.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it. Let's see. Yes, Chair, go ahead.
Steve, the chair here. I just had a quick comment for John on the quarterly report, and thank you for those holiday greetings, and certainly agree that hopefully next year will be a much better year. So under the Strategic Initiatives Regional Transportation Plan update, there's a little section in there that talks about changes to the plan since the last update in 2016. I would have added one, which, you know, I think that the new draft plan that's out that you're now reviewing comments on clearly underscores the need for a sustainable regional revenue source. So I would have added that. I just wanted to make that comment for the record. I know that that's talked about a couple paragraphs down under bi-state transportation consultation, but having looked at every regional transportation plan produced by the agency since 1992, I think that it's worth highlighting that one big change is the need, you know, clearly a need for the regional sustainable revenue source. So thanks, John, for allowing me to make that comment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for that comment, Steve, and I couldn't agree with you more.
Thanks.
Appreciate that.
Yep, agreed. Good comment. Okay, I'm going to pass this to John Marshall now for the General Counsel status report.
No report, Mr. Chair.
Okay, short and sweet today. Thank you, John. All right, now I'm going to go to APC members for any relevant report outs that they may have. Let's see. Garth Alling and Sam Booth are not present, so I'm going to go to Crystal Jacobson next.
Thank you, Brendan. I have a couple of things. First is we, our office, our community development resource office in Tahoe closed down again to the public back in November, kind of right before Thanksgiving. We had been open and having appointments, regular appointments at our counter. We're now doing video appointments, so we're still serving the public, but we did close down given the high, you know, kind of COVID numbers that we're seeing, experiencing in the North Shore. And then I also wanted to just point out that our Tahoe Basin Area Plan housing amendment package that we've been working with the TRPA team on went to our planning commission back in early, I think it was October. We got a recommendation to our board to approve that package, and it's going to our board on the 15th, so next week. And then it'll be coming before the TRPA governing TRPA, APC, and Governing Board. And then also our Resort Triangle Transportation Plan was also approved by our board back in October. And we're working on an implementation plan for that now, and that'll go to our board after the new year. And then finally, just a couple other things. Our Workforce Housing Preservation Program, that's like a deed-restrictive housing program to really preserve workforce housing in our region. That went to our board for kind of a tentative approval in October as well. And we did get that approval from our board, but we're working together now on kind of pulling all the various different components together for final approval for our board, and that we anticipate that going after the new year as well. And then on the project front, I just wanted to point out there's been a lot of chatter in the community. We have a project that's been making its way through the process called La Lima, or Lakeside Redevelopment in Kings Beach. It was denied at our commission back in May, and then they appealed to our board. And we have been having ongoing discussions with the applicants on a redesign of that project for a hotel development on the lakeside in Kings Beach. And so just a heads up that there's a lot of folks talking about that in our community. And then also there's a pre-development project that came in our Tahoe City area for a redevelopment of the Boatworks small site. So we're really excited about that because we feel it really meets the area, you know, the objectives of our area plan and goals of the regional plan. So that's all I have.
Thanks. Great updates. Mr. Calicrate.
Yes, thank you, Chair. So I'm sure if you haven't heard about the TTD wanting to put in a transportation hub at the old elementary school in Incline, which is roundly opposed by the majority of the community because of the high density in the area with you know, housing across the street, shopping, things of that nature. On a steep slope, and you know, there are just a variety of issues that have come up. So the meeting that was scheduled today has been canceled, I believe, that in front of the commission, the county commission. So I have an understanding that I believe tomorrow there is going to be a TTD meeting. I have to get the particulars for that. But we as a community of Incline Village and Crystal Bay are greatly opposed to that site. We feel that there are other opportunities in the area, possibly one that has come up as a Washoe County substation. There was another potential on the main highway of 28 at the corner of Southwood and Highway 28. It was the old Chevron station and a restaurant. The visibility would make it an easier in and out. There are a lot of back and forth. There's some misinformation. But the community is opposed because we have been kind of kept out of the loop until the very, very end. And that just isn't the way to do good business. I know that Carl has come before the TRPA speaking of the merits of this. And there are merits to having a regional transportation hub. We're not opposed to that. But it's the siting at the old elementary school that we are absolutely opposed to. And so we're working through the process. Just to give folks an update, we appreciate the feedback and the concerns from not only the APC, but the governing board as well. And we hope that folks are sensitive to the fact that this will directly impact that area should it be pushed through. There are alternative sites that we would much rather discuss and hopefully come to an agreement on. So that's the latest update on that. We're still awaiting the adoption of our master plan within Washoe County, and we were almost there. So that's it from my neck of the woods. Thank you.
Thanks, Tim. Let's see, Mr. Drake.
Thanks, Brandon. No updates today.
All right. Thank you, Kevin. Mr. Drew.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Two things, one work-related, one not work-related. On the work-related note, speaking to what John and Steve mentioned earlier, obviously local jurisdictions have been especially hit hard with revenue during the COVID-19 situation. We are working on two different revenue initiatives in the state. And what's interesting is that gas tax has come back pretty strong and is looking strong as we move into the last quarter of this year and the first quarter of next year. And so from an SB1 standpoint, it has been looking good for counties. Cities are starting to recognize that having dedicated revenue sources for the different kinds of infrastructure that they're responsible for maintaining and managing and operating is certainly been highlighted as a need. And I think that we will see more jurisdictions across the two states pursuing dedicated revenue for different kinds of infrastructure, whether it's trails or roads, water infrastructure, stormwater, flood control. We've definitely seen that trend in having those discussions across the state. And I think that goes along with the idea of One Tahoe or other funding initiatives that have been discussed here in the basin. So I think that we will see that continue as we move into 2021. On a non-work note, as everybody knows, our communities are certainly struggling with a number of items as a result of business shutdowns and other factors related to COVID. And some of you may be aware, certainly our local food pantries, there's three or four of them around the lake, are really hurting. And so NCE, my firm, we've made a fairly substantial donation to the local food banks here in Southlake, and you're going to see opportunities to help those organizations. So I would encourage all of us that have been lucky enough to keep our jobs and have our businesses open to do what we can, because there's certainly a lot of people in the community who are hurting right now. And there definitely shouldn't be anybody going hungry as we move through the holidays. So if you can, I would certainly support our local food banks and food pantries because they are struggling to keep up with the current need in the community. Thank you.
Thank you, Drew.
Yeah, thanks, Jason. That's good news. Mr. Grego.
No report on business, but let's hope that 2021 is a more normal year. Thank you.
Amen. Mr. Gavon. Eric, we cannot hear you, but I do see you're unmuted. You still can't hear you. Let me move on to Mr. Hill, and we'll see if we can correct your audio.
Nothing to report today. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Kevin. Mr. Letton?
Nothing to report. Thanks, Brandon.
Thanks, Ben. Mr. Plemmel.
Nothing for me either. Thank you.
Thanks, Lee. Ms. Roverud.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just report out to the commission that the city has been working on updating our residential development and design standards, been utilizing a state grant and working to achieve state directives and goals to create objective standards to and reduce the uncertainty in developing housing within our communities. So we've been working on that, and we expect it to go before our planning commission for recommendation to City Council in January. And that, I think it was Mr. Young that brought up earlier in the meeting more modern design styles and standards related to those. We have included in the draft a section that would apply to multifamily properties, where we're looking at different architectural styles and what design standards would apply to those. And we do have a modern and contemporary, mountain modern and contemporary architectural style category. And those are really the buildings that have a much simpler form, not the level of architectural detail that you might see on some of the more historical mountain architecture, single roof planes, things like that. So I'm more than happy to share that if it's something that you're interested in or any of the other APC members. And other than that, just wish all the APC members a healthy holiday season.
Thank you, Hillary. That sounds good. Ms. Stoller?
Hi, yes, thanks, Mr. Chair. I do have a couple of items to report out from the state of Nevada. The first is the Division of State Lands. We serve as staff to the Nevada Tahoe Regional Planning Agency, or NTRPA. which has oversight of Structures Housing Gaming, otherwise known as casinos. And we are, we recently held an NTRPA governing board meeting to elect an at-large member. And that new member is Haley Williamson. She is a Tahoe resident. She is a lawyer with a land use and environmental planning background. And she also currently serves as chairman of the Public Utilities Commission of Nevada. So in addition to serving on the NTRPA board, she will also serve as a Nevada representative, the at-large member for TRPA. So I just want to let you guys know that you will be seeing her in the future at governing board. Second item is that we've closed our water quality and Lake Tahoe license plate grant rounds. We're now considering applications and we're looking forward to making awards next year in February. And then finally, I'm really excited to report that our Division of Forestry Forester, who works on our NTRT or Nevada Tahoe Resource Team, has an approved burn plan for Lake Tahoe Nevada State Park. So if you guys know, if you're at the Spooner unit of Lake Tahoe Nevada State Park and you walk around Spooner Lake, you'll notice we have a lot of wood piles that are ready to be burned. Those are the focus of his burn plan. And so if weather cooperates later this season, we'll be able to dispose of those piles. Those are my updates. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Ellery. Mr. Teixeira.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just for the record, the Tahoe Transportation District Board meeting is Friday of this week. I think someone said Thursday. It's Friday, and it's at 9:30. It's a virtual meeting. We use GoToWebinar, and if people are interested, you can go to the TTD website, TahoeTransportation.org, to get information on how to participate in the meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Mr. Young.
Hello, thank you. Happy holidays, everyone. Ellery, that was great news about the appointment to the Nevada TRPA. That's going to be great for everybody. From Washoe County, Tim is right. We are moving forward, but we actually have a date, January 26th. For the final county commission meeting for our area plan. Then we've been working with Michael Conger, who's always so helpful to go ahead and get our TRPA meetings scheduled. So it looks like we have the possibility of being done with our area plan and completely adopted by the end of March. So that's pretty exciting for us. And then we're eager to see how the implementation goes, to see how well it works. But we're not hesitant to make an adjustment if TRPA and our local experience feel like we need to. Similar to some of the things we've heard from others, I really noticed in earlier presentation by TRPA that they're somewhat proud of their response over the year of 2020 to the adjustments that needed to be made to the COVID pandemic. I think that you should be proud. I think you've done a great job in keeping things rolling. But I'd like to also mention that my own organization, Washoe County, I'm very proud of them. You know, we have a pretty significant COVID issue here in the Truckee Meadows. We can't quite seem to get past it, but my organization, Washoe County, despite some issues with, you know, revenue like all of us have in local government, from the planning and building side, from the development side, from the customer service side, even though you can't come into the building, you can still contact anybody, you can still get business done. And I'm sure all of you feel similar about your organizations, but I heard TRPA rightfully have some pride in their response, and I want to let you know that I have some pride in
my own organization's ability to keep the ball rolling and keep the doors open to the community during 2020. That's all I've got. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, Eric. That's all the members. I just have a couple quick things. Our office, too, is closed in the Tahoe Basin. We are completely open on the western slope of our county. So continuing to serve the public is a huge priority for us. I feel like we're busier than ever, so lots going on for us. There is a Myers Advisory Council meeting next Tuesday evening, 4 to 6 p.m. I'll be sending the agenda out for that today for anyone interested. And then I just want to mention that the Albany County Board of Supervisors met on December 2nd for the final reading of ordinance amendments to our vacation home rental ordinance and instituted a cap on vacation home rental permits in the Tahoe Basin at 900 permits. We currently have about 750. And so there is a new cap involved. They've directed us to come back with some clustering concepts to try to prevent EHRs from being, you know, clustered around residences, et cetera. So we'll be coming back with that. Anyone want to talk more about that, get in touch with me, but it's kind of a big new step for us. I think I was remiss in going back to Mr. Gay Vaughn. I see that you are unmuted again, Eric. Do you have any updates you want to share?
Yes, I do. If you can still, can you hear me?
Yes, we can now.
All right. I had some technical difficulties today during the meeting, so it probably made the meeting go really smooth. Less of Mr. Gavon. the fire season has been extraordinary this year, as you all know. We did talk about that with the air quality and how it's important. Right now, we are doing a lot of, I shouldn't say a lot, but we are starting our prescribed burn program in the basin. You'll see Sugar Pine Point has some burning, and you heard that Spooner unit is working. We are at Tahoe Douglas doing some fuels reduction down in Glenbrook. And so those fires are there. If you want to get information or you're concerned about, see a smoke plume, you can go with TahoeLivingWithFire.com info, TahoeLivingWithFire.com info, and there is a prescribed burning map on there, and you can bring it up and see who's responsible for that burn, what areas they're burning in. So it's really good. It helps you to be aware of your situational awareness in the basin. Thank you, TRPA. You're on target. I didn't get to make any comments necessarily on the air quality, but certainly that is something that we are really mindful of as we're doing these burns, and how important it is for us to monitor the weather and make sure that smoke leaves the basin when we're doing these prescribed burns, but also keeping in mind that these wildfires, they really impact air quality greatly. So if we can reduce that, we were down in Reno because of an energy fire, it looks like, where the power lines caused a fire down in Reno that caused several homes to be lost. So we continue to work with the power company to make sure that that we're hardening our area up here and able to pre-treat areas so that we don't have a similar catastrophe. So there's a lot of work that's being done. I'd like to give kudos to TRPA for the technical technology, the steps forward. As you know, I've been always a strong proponent for that and even pushed for electronic plan submittal back before COVID. And now they've made great leaps forward this year. And so I'm very proud of that for TRPA. And I think that is really a good step in the right direction. Chief Baker is retiring. He actually officially retired this month, but the board asked him to stay on. So Chief Baker's retiring. He was the head of the Tahoe Fire and Fuels team. He's done a lot of work with the fireboat program and has been very active in the basin. And we wish him the best in his retirement. We have a new chief coming on board, Scott Lindegren. Scott Lindegren starts with us this month, and the official handoff will happen during our board meeting next month. But that has some implications for the the basin as far as the Tahoe Fire and Fuels team and the work that was being done by Chief Baker, but we definitely applaud him. And then we also have a new assistant chief, Bryce Cranch, was promoted due to a retirement. So a lot of motion over here for us. And then the VHRs are full to capacity in our area. Vacation home rentals are the brokers are telling me that they'll get a cancellation and within 2 to 3 days it fills, that they've never seen numbers like what they're seeing now. I don't think California is helping us out much when they're closing down. I think that's going to push a lot this direction, but you know, people got to do what they need to do to keep people safe. And so I'm not sure the implications that will have on the Nevada side, but it definitely seems to push some tourism and some people staying up here and some concerns during the New Year's Eve celebrations as well. So I know we're looking at numbers in hospitals and the shutdown and COVID and where that might be. So our rooms have been at a higher census, and we just need to watch that. And then this last month, a lot of activity going on. Of course, the RDA was voted down by the public, and that goes to the county commissioners, and that could impact the fire department as far as our agreements with the proponents for a fire station in the Casino Core, and the development that supporting that the vent center. So a lot going on. If you have any other questions, you can either talk to me, and also Steve Teixeira is a great person to reach out to when it comes to the RDA and the event center as well. So thank you all for everything you do, and Merry Christmas.
Thank you, Eric. Yeah, same to you. Okay, that concludes APC member comments. I'm going to move to our last item here, item 8, public interest comments. Members of the public participating in our virtual webinar should raise their hand now to indicate they wish to speak, and a TRPA staff member will unmute you. Please note, APC is prohibited by law from taking immediate action on or discussing issues raised by the public that are not listed on the agenda. So I'll turn this over to you, Catherine, if we have any public comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have no hands raised to make public comment at this time.
Okay. Thank you, Catherine. With that, it is 12:07, and I would entertain a motion to adjourn this meeting.
So moved, Bruce Grego.
Second, right. Tim Kellicray.
Thank you, Bruce and Tim. Any opposed? All right. All are in favor for the motion to adjourn.
Aye. Thank you, Chair.
Aye. Aye. Thank you all for a great meeting. Everyone stay safe and healthy in the holiday season ahead. I hope you enjoy it. And we will see you in the new year.